Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I'm Randall Strauss. I'm the author of The Launchpad, Inside Y Combinator, Silicon Valley's most exclusive school for startups. And tonight, Inforum is hosting Y Combinator, the secret in this incubator sauce. Joined by Harsh Tagore, a Y Combinator alum, co-founder of Octomatic, and today, a YC partner. Joe Gebbia, chief product officer and co-founder of Airbnb, and graphic and user experience guru. Steve Huffman, two-time YC graduate, first as a co-founder of Reddit in the very first batch of YC in summer 2005, and most recently his travel startup Hipmunk from the summer 2010 batch. And Jude Gamilla, serial entrepreneur and blogger, co-founder of HazeApp, a social discovery platform for mobile and online games. These YC graduates are here to share their success stories so that we can get a look inside Y Combinator, today a Silicon Valley icon. So let's get to it. I'll start with Harsh. I'm going to ask you a question in your capacity as a partner where you have interviewed many, many applicants. We'll spend some time talking about how do you get into YC, then we'll talk about what happens after you do. But let me ask you, as someone who has looked at a lot of applications over the years, what is it, do you think, that applicants would be advised to keep in mind that they tend not to be aware of?
You mean specifically when filling out the Y Combinator application?
Yes.
Brevity, conciseness would be the number one choice. If you need too many words to explain something, it's kind of a bad sign. And just practically, it's hard when you're reading hundreds of applications. Just like when you just open up one and you see a wall of text, your immediate mental frame is sort of a groan. And it's not the best way to start off an application. So keeping it concise would be good. And making meaningful statements. So for example, PG's written about this, but A lot of applications we see are from smart people, but they're used to a more corporate environment with corporate speak. So rather than, for example, saying that they're working on a site to enable you to rent out your couch or your spare room to someone, they'll say, "We are revolutionizing the world of social communication and collaboration via online digital means." And it's just, I've read a few of those. And it just doesn't really help you. So just pay attention to that.
Joe, can you go back to when you applied?
We had about 2 hours before the deadline. I remember Brian and I, my co-founder, were sitting in his bedroom. It's 10 o'clock at night. We're scrambling to fill in all these fields that Harsh was just talking about. We had, brevity wasn't an option for us. About 2 hours left. There's something I remember profoundly about our experience, which was we were lucky enough to get to the interview, and we had the interview process with PG, Jessica, and the other partners back when it was just a few partners. And right before we were leaving, I looked down at my bag and I realized that we brought them a gift, and I almost forgot to give them the gift. So I paused Brian and Nate. I said, "Guys, wait, we have to give this to PG and Jessica." So I pulled this gift out of my bag and I walked back in the interview room where they're compiling their notes. And the interview room is very small, by the way. It's this very small office. It's very kind of like crowded together. It's very huddled. And I interrupt them. I say, "PG, this is for you." And I hand him probably the most unexpected thing he's ever gotten after a YC interview. It was a box of breakfast cereal. It was a relic from something that we had designed when we were in the trough of sorrows at Airbnb. We weren't making any money. We decided to make a politically themed breakfast cereal called Obama O's right around the time of the 2008 presidential election. And we hand him this box, and he looks at it and he goes, "Wait, you bought this for me?" And we go, "No, we made it." And he goes, "What do you mean you made it?" And we go, well, let's tell you the story. So in 60 seconds, we told him how we made the cereal, we sold it, funded the company in the early days. And he instantly turns around and puts it on the shelf right behind his desk, front and center, and later tells us, after we get into YC, he said, you know, guys, I really didn't have a lot of confidence in the idea. Because I thought this whole notion of people sharing space around the world is just crazy. But I let you in because you had the hustle to make breakfast cereal to fund your company. And so, if you piece it all together, the reason that we actually got into YC is because we made breakfast cereal.
Steve, you were in the very first batch. So first, how did you, there was no Y Combinator to know about, so tell us about how you heard about the opportunity and how things went when you applied.
Sure, so it started because I was a fan of Paul Grant. You know, he had written essays that I had read through high school and college that evangelized programming in this language called Lisp, that evangelized startups, and this kind of his whole path to success. And so everything got started for us when he gave a talk at Harvard spring break of my senior year of college called How to Start a Startup. And my co-founder at Reddit, Alexis, and I, we took the train up from Virginia to see this talk, and afterwards we met Paul and basically badgered him to come out to dinner with us. Well, I had my dog-eared copy of Paul's book, and I was otherwise speechless, so Alexis did most of the talking, and I just got him to sign my book, and he was like, well, if you guys came all the way up from Virginia and brought my book, the least of, you know, least I can do is meet with you guys. So we met with them, told them our startup idea that Alexis and I had planned on starting after we graduated, which was ordering food from your cell phones, and he loved the idea. We went back home, I was super excited, and he announced Y Combinator, they're going to do this funding thing. And I had emailed him thanking him for, you know, taking the time to meet us and talk about our idea. And he replied and said, oh, you know, if you guys are those two from Virginia, you should definitely apply to this new thing called Y Combinator. So we applied, we got invited back up to Cambridge for an interview, did a 40-minute interview. The interviews are now 10 minutes. Did this 40-minute interview talking about this food thing. We had already talked to Paul about this food thing for like an hour and a half a few months ago when he loved the idea. A couple days later, he called us and rejected us. And I remember just being at the time, you're like, Paul, you made us travel an awful long way to reject us on an idea that you had already heard. So Alexis and I got, you know, super drunk. on the train ride back home to Virginia, he called Alexis and said, you know, we really like you guys. And if you want to be in Y Combinator, come back up, and we'll kind of figure out what you guys should work on. So we got off the train, jumped the tracks, got the next train going north, met with Paul, and we just had this kind of brainstorming session where we would decide we would build the front page of the web. And that's how we started working on Reddit.
These guys have amazing stories. So for us, I'd landed in San Francisco in summer 2008, and I was really up for starting a company, looking for my co-founder. So I found my co-founder, and weirdly speaking, he was right next to me. I'd known him for 15 years, and he was out here doing his own company. And I'd been doing a co-founder search for about 1 to 2 years, trying to do various businesses, find a co-founder, and try and build a company and get out to Silicon Valley. So my co-founder had done Y Combinator, luckily, just before in a previous batch. And we emailed Paul. He said, come in. We didn't have to do the application. And I'm not sure whether we're allowed to say that. But
you can say it.
We didn't do the application, and we met Paul Graham. He took us out for a walk, and we didn't go to a room for an interview. So we went outside and sat in the sun in Mountain View on the curbside, and we talked about the business for about 10 minutes. And he said, I don't know what you guys are gonna make, but I really like you, and I wanna fund you. And that was it. We got the money in the bank, and we were like, let's go. We started working 24 hours a day since then.
One of the distinctive features of Y Combinator is it does not provide workspace by design. Paul Graham has a lot of thoughts about why it's important not to have the companies working in a shared space. Looking back, tell us a little about your living/work situation when you went through.
We actually had an interesting experience with that. So we were working on our startup in England, and we had met Evan Williams, founder of Blogger and Twitter, at a conference. And when we told him we were coming out to work at Y Combinator, or not work at Y Combinator, to go through Y Combinator, he said that he had a sort of co-working type space that had a few spare desks, and if we wanted them, we would be more than welcome to them. And it turned out that that incubator was called Obvious Corp, which is what Twitter spun out of. And so we were there when Twitter, like, was just sort of growing, in particular the South by Southwest, where it exploded. And as a co-working space, it was just about perfect in the sense of it was a great space. You had a tremendously successful company which created like this sort of energy about the place. Everyone there was incredibly smart. And so it was ideal, except that I would say about after 3 weeks, we kind of stopped going because it seemed like, and we were living 5 minute walk away. We would just get up and start working and then just continue working. Like even walking to this space that was 5 minutes away sort of seemed like we didn't have time to do it. And so we just kept living and working out of our apartments because we just didn't want to get distracted.
Yeah. Some other stories?
Well, you know, Alexis and I, that first summer of Reddit, we worked out of our apartment. And that made it impossible to basically not be working all of the time. You know, any time where we weren't working, it was just the two of us. We had no, like even our friends in NYC, we weren't friends with them yet. That first summer was very isolating. You know, it was really just the two of us. And so when we weren't working, we were always like kind of talking about Reddit and thinking about Reddit. And then things really changed. After the summer ended, YC left and came out here to do a round in Palo Alto. And we started working out of the YC office that was you know, left abandoned, basically, because we were just tired of sitting in our apartment all day. And at the same time, Justin and Emmett, the founders of Kiko, we're working out of that office. And we worked together out of the YC office for about 6 months together, the two companies. And I remember that was really, really great because we kind of went through these kind of company growing pains together. You know, they were a little bit ahead of us. They had an employee. And like I was like, man, Emmett, how do you deal with an employee? but it was like really, it was a really fun time where we kind of like debug each other's code, fix each other's stuff, test each other's things. And as we're just kind of learning together, like how to like get these things off the ground. It was really a formative experience.
There was something that we all realized in the room where we were prepping before this, which was that we all happened to land and work out of San Francisco when Y Combinator is in Mountain View. And we found it just kind of fascinating that there's been a shift to San Francisco for tech companies. And I think Steve was probably the first tech company to come up to San Francisco.
Yeah, it was interesting time because Reddit sold the fall of 2006. And at the same time, Justin and Emmett had just sold Kiko on eBay. And they were going to start Justin TV, which would later spin out Twitch TV and SocialCam. We decided we were going to move to San Francisco at the same time. So we did this Google search of apartments in San Francisco. And the first result that came up was for Crystal Towers in North Beach. And so they moved out here. About a month later, I moved out. And about 6 months later, Justin was getting evicted. And there were, I think, 13 or 14 apartments in that building that belonged to Y Combinator companies. And it had turned into this basically startup dorm. And it was an amazing experience.
Because it had two features, right? It had furnished rooms and short-term contracts.
Yeah, month-to-month lease, and it was fully furnished.
Which is a pretty rare combination.
Yeah, and so everybody just came out here at the spur of the moment, basically. And so there was us, some of us from the previous batches, and then all of the new batches who were living in San Francisco moved in. And I think...
And I'd heard of this magical building, Crystal Towers. I was in the UK in London, you know, solo entrepreneur trying to get my stuff together. And I just imagined this massive crystal in the sky. and so when I came out here, I hadn't gotten to YC, and I slept on the floor in Crystal Towers for 4 months, not paying any rent. And it was just like a dorm. Like, everything was crazy in there. The people that were running the building didn't know what was going on. They had all these computers and screens and people coming and going, carpets that were destroyed, and people dropping things off the roof, and pool parties where people were talking about tech. And we pitched our early Haze Up ideas around the pool with all these people at the bottom of Crystal Towers, and decided to do Haze Up off the back of lots of feedback from entrepreneurs that were in the building. And we were popping into different buildings, seeing how people were doing. It was quite an interesting time. Like, our first desk was a coffee table, circular coffee table, in in the back of someone else's house in Crystal Palace.
Well, and the building tried to do all these... Once they caught on what was going on, that all these companies were being run out of these apartments, they tried to get everybody kicked out. But they already had rules that said you couldn't run businesses, and they couldn't prove that people were running businesses, so they started making rules like no power strips, because that's like a fire hazard. And so I had the fire marshal show up randomly at my day one, like, or random one morning at my place, saying, like, we need to inspect your apartment for power strips. And they did that to everybody, just to, like, try to kick us all out. We had this, like, rotating laptops. We used to hide each other's computers in each other's apartments when they were doing inspections to keep, like, Y Combinator at bay. Or, I'm sorry, Crystal Towers at bay.
Harsh, you did not find it easy to get... Housing,
no,
right?
We actually we tried moving into the building, and there's sort of like a reception at the base of the building, and I went in and asked them if they had any rooms, and they said, yep, we have tons of rooms, you can move in this afternoon. It's like, great. So just walk around the corner to the sales office to sign the paperwork. As we were walking out, Justin of Justin.tv was walking in, and I stopped to talk to him for about 5 minutes. And when I got to the sales office, magically, there weren't any rooms left, apparently. And it turned out after a few days of trying to figure this out, they eventually just said, actually, the whole story is, they told us we didn't have credit, and I have an uncle who lives in the Bay Area, and so I asked him, would he mind putting his name to the lease? And so it would be on his, they would check his credit, and they told me a couple of days later that your uncle has bad credit. So I had this awkward conversation with my uncle. I'm like, so... they say that your credit check didn't pass, and so he gets really annoyed, calls them up, says, what's wrong with my credit? And they say, actually, it's less your credit and more about your nephew's affiliation with certain organizations. to which he then calls me back, and is like, what the hell are you doing? it was a very bizarre experience. Yeah.
Joe, when you were going through Y Combinator, do you recall any Paul Graham stories of...
Oh, my God. Yes. PG, a lot of people don't realize that we had actually launched before YC. And we had our moment where they call it the tech crunch of initiation, where you launch and your traffic goes from basically nothing to a lot overnight. And you look at that graph in Google Analytics and you think, we made it. You see that graph and you're like, yes, we're doing it. Like, we got on TechCrunch, we got on the blogs. The graph's going to keep going, right? And I think, as we all know, it doesn't keep going. It comes right back down. And so we experienced that about 6 months before YC, and we lived in this state that we all know of called the trough of sorrow, which is basically this moment where you have this product and you have this market, but they don't yet connect. It's like two gears that are not yet touching. And so we lived in the state for... I don't know, 6 months or so, if not more. And it wasn't the, you know, people ask, what was the turning point for us? And it was the moment that we got into YC. And it was that first question out of Paul Graham's mouth. He goes, where's your market? And Brian Nate and I looked at each other. We go, well, you know, this is, really isn't taking off anywhere, but on the East Coast, this is working out pretty well. And he goes, so let me hear this. Your users... Wait, let me do my Paul Graham voice.
It's really good, by the way. The voice is uncanny. It's scary.
He also does this thing with his finger. He goes, your users are on the East Coast, but you're here in Mountain View. And we all look at each other like, yeah, we're here for the program. Long pause. He goes, your users are on the East Coast, but you're here in Mountain View. Another awkward long pause, and he goes, what are you still doing here? Go to the East Coast. And that weekend, we took a trip out to the East Coast. And we learned a very powerful lesson from Paul Graham. And that lesson was, go meet your users. Go meet the people. Go meet the people behind your product. We had sat behind our computer screens in our apartment for at least 6 months trying to solve problems through code. And it honestly didn't get us anywhere. It wasn't until Paul Graham's advice of go meet the people that we actually sat down with the early adopters, and we heard straight from their mouths exactly what was wrong with the product, and we started to iterate very quickly. And so during YC, those gears started to connect.
Jude, do you recall any times when you did not take advice you were given at Y Combinator?
Yeah, so one of them was for us to situate ourselves in Mountain View, so it would be close to Y Combinator, close to base, because they had about twice to three times a week they had speakers, really great speakers, come in and talk to us. And we dreaded having to take this train journey down to Mountain View if we placed ourselves in San Francisco. But we just broke the rules. We thought, well, Dropbox are in San Francisco, and they're doing pretty well. And we like San, we're city people. We like San Francisco, and I would be seriously bored in Mountain View. I don't know what I'd do with myself. So we broke that rule of placing ourselves down there. And then we broke a second rule, that we were supposed to turn up to these meals and kind of participate and go to the talks. And we stopped, well, we kind of didn't really go to the talks. So we only went to about one per week because we wanted to save time. We wanted to code, we wanted to design, we wanted to make HAZAP. So we skipped a couple of talks as well. But I think we followed the rest of the advice.
Because of the odd way in which we got into Y Combinator with Reddit, Reddit was like one of Paul's pet projects, basically. And so he was in my inbox constantly. And it was... This was annoying for a couple of reasons. Because one, it's just like, Paul, I'm trying to work. And I got this guy being like, why don't you do this? At one point, he's like, you should turn it into a dating site. No, wait, you should merge with Kiko because Kiko's an online calendar. And I was like, what? And he's like, well, because if you put your calendar in Reddit, then you'll never have to leave. I was like, Paul, that's great. And then he had this like weird email client that he wrote that would add double spacing to all of his replies. So we'd have these really long email chains that would gradually get like more and more separated, so you couldn't even read them anymore. But one piece of advice he gave us that stuck with us, that I still carry with me, is he told us deals fall through. This was during the Reddit acquisition time. And he was like, deals fall through. Don't get excited. Deals always fall through. And he would say this so much that Alexis took this picture of Paul Graham where Paul's wagging his finger, and he put in big white black letters on top of his picture, deals fall through. And we framed that picture and then hung it on the wall in our bathroom, right opposite the toilet, so we would see it every day. And we always had this in our head, deals fall through. And then when Reddit finally sold, we got Paul to sign it for us, and then we gave it to Justin TV. And now I believe it still sits in their bathroom. So if they eventually figure things out.
There's actually something about hanging things in your bathroom that came out of YC. Which is, Paul told us, this is another piece of advice that he told us on day one. He said, whatever you do, by demo day, which is where you present to all the investors, he said, make sure that you show a graph that goes up and to the right, and then label it on the next frame, not traffic, not users, but revenue. Whatever you do, get that graph up and to the right for revenue. And so Brian, Nate, and I were like, okay, Paul, yeah, okay, we'll do it. And we actually, we drew out a graph of what that would actually look like. We kind of forecasted into the future during the next 3 months of Y Combinator what that graph would look like, kind of like made it up, right, getting to ramen profitable. And we put it on the bathroom mirror, we put it next to our computer screens, we put it inside the fridge. When you open the fridge door, it was like next to the milk, like staring back at you. So at night when we're brushing our teeth, all of us were so focused on how do we become ramen profitable, and it was all because we hung this piece of paper in our bathroom.
Harsh, for those who are not familiar with the term ramen profitable, could you give everyone a quick explanation?
ramen, which I'm sure you all know. I didn't actually know when I moved to the States what ramen was, but instant noodles. Ramen profitable is at the point where you're making enough money such that you can cover all of your costs or potentially... some more, assuming that you only eat ramen.
So we in HAZAP, we've invented a few more phrases. We've got sushi profitable, 5A5 steak lounge profitable. We've got a whole range of profitability. It's like, how profitable are you?
Pork shop profitable.
Pork shop profitable. We've got a whole range of them. So you can ask people about, how profitable are by food.
Pizza profitable.
Pizza profitable. Starving.
We took it pretty literally. Like, we had stocks and stocks of ramen noodles, and I still kind of get a gag reflex now when I walk past that aisle in Safeway.
There's an early Paul Graham essay where he talks about how Y Combinator was conceived as an experiment to see just how low you could push the minimum threshold of founders. And it occurs to me, Steve, you came obviously right out of school.
Yep.
Jude, the same for you? Almost
one and a half years out.
Okay. It was the case for
it
you.
It was straight off there.
Yeah. Was that a good age? Get your first, to enter YC, but probably in your cases, you had prior entrepreneurial experience, right? Or not?
I didn't.
At college, you did.
In the sense of, for us, it started as I was just bored at college. I wasn't particularly engaged with my degree, and I was looking for something to do that was interesting, and this sort of side project just grew, and I realized I was more excited about that than anything, so we just continued. We continued working on it and applied to YC and got into it, but I hadn't set out to sort of start a company or be an entrepreneur. It kind of just happened, and so it was a good age in a sense. Like if I look back, I definitely think we had the advantage of just not knowing how hard things were. And it's a different ball game when you start a company knowing, like sort of having seen stuff and knowing what the future is going to be like.
Well, that leads to a question for Steve, who has gone through YC twice. Was the second time easier or actually harder because you kind of knew?
Well, it's funny because
the
when,
challenges.
I always say, when we started Reddit, I knew nothing. I was 20, I had just graduated college, and I didn't know anything about business. And then I would say during Reddit, even after the acquisition, I stayed on for quite a while, and I'd always say, my next startup, I've learned all of these lessons, all these really important things. I've learned how to manage people, and I can't wait to do another one because I can, not repeat all of these mistakes that I made the first time with Reddit. And so we started Hipmunk, and things were a lot easier. We did a lot of things better because we knew all those lessons. But now I'm saying the same thing, which is like, oh my gosh, I had no idea how much I didn't know when we started Hipmunk. And now I feel the same thing in my head where it's like, I can't wait for the next one because we're going to do everything so much better this time. Because at Reddit, at its largest, when we sold, we were four people. And when I left, we were six. And so I learned all sorts of really valuable technology things on how to scale a website. But like actually running a business and hiring and having a large team, we didn't even touch at Reddit. And now at Hipmunk, it's much bigger scale, and we make much more money, and it's the challenges are much, much greater. I don't know. We'll see how many iterations I go through before I feel like I know everything, but my suspicion is that may never happen.
And to your point on how far you can go in terms of the cost base, so me and Imad were spending about $5.2K a month on everything. That was the entire business cost, our own personal costs. And then... right after we got the YC Combinator money, we got it in September 2008. Our batch started in January 2009. So we had to survive 6 months on the Y Combinator money, everything. And towards the end of Y Combinator, me and Imad were out of money. We were out of money actually halfway through the batch. And so we started going into our credit cards. And we were like, how far should we go? And we just kept going downwards. And then we started doing cost cutting. So we got this nice apartment that was like 2.5K a month. That was most of our budget spent on the flat. So we started running out of money. We couldn't take a bus. We couldn't even take the bus. We couldn't come down to Y Combinator anymore because that was a train.
Whoa.
I'm not kidding you. Like, whoa. Our credit cards, like, we were out. Like, the credit cards were maxed. Couldn't get any more. And we kept pushing it. And we're like, okay, well, we had about $1,000 left to take. We got a call from Union Square Ventures, who are a VC in New York, who funded Twitter, Zynga, and we had pitched various different people. Union Square Ventures called us up and we were like, shall we spend our last $600 on the trip out to Union Square Ventures? We told Union Square Ventures we wouldn't even do a phone call with them. That's how crazy we were. We're like, we're not having a phone call. We don't have time. We don't have time to speak to like the best VC in out there. So we said, we don't have time. So we talked on email to them. And then we flew out there, and I was, like, regretting it. It was raining in New York, and my shoes had holes in them, and I was like, what am I doing here in the USA, like, with no cash and going negative in the money? And then we actually managed to land the term sheet, and we cut it pretty fine on that one because we had to spend a lot of money on the visas as well. So the YC money is about as low as you can push it, I think, right now.
I think there's a theme that YC inspires creativity. Because you literally have nothing.
Yeah. We were using, we were collecting the quarters. We were like, oh wow, there's a few quarters there. We could use that. It was bad.
At one point, it sounds like we both raised what we call the visa round. Yeah. Which is where you have to resort to credit cards to fund your business. But I think Y Combinator, it forces you to think creatively because you literally have no other options.
Well, before the winter 2011 batch.
That's right.
And the outside
actually, of- was pretty special because we started in January of 2009, and if you dial back a couple months to October of 2008, what was the big event that happened that month? Lehman's went under, and the entire economy with it. And so
it was really, really hard.
Yeah, Paul sent us an email. You remember what he said? He said, if you want to defer from this batch, you can because we don't think anyone's going to invest. That's how bad it was.
It was a complete funding freeze on everything. Angels, VCs, no one wanted to fund good companies. It was tough.
I want to come back to college experiences. Would it have been helpful to have had some formal major in entrepreneurship or not at all? That part of what you do is you learn as you need it. That there is no need to get formal academic training in this thing called entrepreneurship. How do you feel? Anybody have strong feelings about this?
I do. I think if you look at the entrepreneur case studies, they come from all backgrounds. Some don't have degrees. Some have degrees. There have been great entrepreneurs from every single place in like geolocation, every single place that you could look for them. So I don't think it is necessary.
Well, it's obviously not necessary.
Yeah.
Because of what you just said.
And I'm sure it doesn't necessarily help either.
Yeah, and if you started like an entrepreneurship program, my suspicion is that the entrepreneurs wouldn't take it. Because nobody, like, I feel like few people know they're going to be entrepreneurs when they're in college. Right? It's something that's very difficult to plan your life around. There are obvious, like, things you could learn in such a program that would be really beneficial. But I think the people who would benefit from having that knowledge probably wouldn't be taking those classes. They'd be doing something else or screwing off, probably flunking out of college, to be honest.
I agree with that. I think the experience of YC is like entrepreneur boot camp. I think the experience that YC affords aspiring entrepreneurs is this three-month structure that holds you accountable every week. You show up or you don't. You take Paul's advice or you don't. There's a midterm with prototype day right in the middle, and then there's the final exam at the end with demo day. And for us, it was like that focus, that ability to just pour ourselves in 110%. It was what finally got that graph turning around. Thank goodness that YC had that experience.
Yeah, and YC created, I remember my first weekend at college, and we had like this, some sort of dorm meeting with our RAs. And our RAs were like, you need to be back here at 7 o'clock. And somebody asked, can we go away like for a couple hours? And the RA was like, yeah, you're adults now. Do what you want. And it was like this really like kind of mind-opening thing. It's like, oh my God, we're adults now. And then when you get into Y Combinator, Paul is just like, 20-year-old kid, here's a check. Good luck. And that's it. Like, see you on Tuesday if you want. And this is your life now, right? You have to live, you know, pay your rent, buy your food, and run your company on 15 grand. You know, good luck. And that was it. And then I remember that moment. It's just like, oh, Paul Graham just gave me a check. I was just so excited just to meet Paul Graham. Let alone, it didn't even occur to me that like my life had like profoundly changed at that moment. But that's, you know, you're kind of out on your own and, you know, you can sink or swim.
I agree. I don't think there should be a formalized sort of entrepreneurship course at college, but I do think there's an opportunity to sort of destructure the environment a bit. So I at least found that college for me was very much, as soon as you got in, geared towards, it was essentially like a conveyor belt towards a very specific type of job. I think the best thing you could do for entrepreneurship for people at college would be to give them an environment where there was more unstructured time where they could just work on things for fun, like projects. And it doesn't have to be like a tech startup. It could be whatever their interest is. If they want to work on a nonprofit, I don't know, if they just want to mess around with materials or something. Like, but giving people, like giving students more autonomy to discover what things are you actually interested in and why don't you go and test out those interests in a more unstructured way would yield to better entrepreneurship. Because actually often the best companies come from people, like Apple started from Steve Wozniak building a computer for fun. Facebook was Mark Zuckerberg just playing around with stuff. Like, if that was okay and not seen as sort of slacking off, you would see a lot of interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, college universities are in a unique position because they do this in a lot of ways already to provide like a soft landing for you. You know, you already have this kind of, you learn how to be an adult, and there's like food halls and places to live, and you've got lots of, you know, mentors and professors and that sort of thing. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense for them to provide, it would make a lot of sense for them to provide just, you know, opportunities to try and fail a few times without going into complete poverty.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Like, university is very geared to everything you do there. You have to try and pass a grade, be successful. They never, like, took you through something and you failed and that was a good experience. Like, it always went against you. And I think that doesn't prep people up for the real world and entrepreneurship of dealing with failure and it being okay as part of the training cycle. So maybe courses can be adjusted to not encourage failure, but make it part of it so you can try something out, it can fail, and then continue. And you don't get graded on it.
Y Combinator doesn't have all that long of a history, being founded in 2005, and yet a lot's happened since Steve went through in the first batch. And hearing you four talk about the size of your batches compared to the most recent batches, that makes it sound like it was a long time ago. It actually wasn't. When you look at the landscape today, what ways do you think it's easier to found a company than it was way back when, in 2009, 2010, when you went through? Or went through most recently?
Well,
any thoughts?
I mean, there's some really obvious things. You know, just the whole notion of like web services. You know, Amazon AWS. Like when Reddit had servers, we made the servers and then took them to the data center and screwed them in. That was like a big pain in the ass. Now you can just kind of a few clicks have a server. There's all this kind of cultural acceptance of startups now. Mm-hmm. You know, 5 years ago, outside of the Bay Area, that the word startup was a meaningless word, right? If I was at home in Virginia and I said I'm doing a startup, they'd be like, "What?" They wouldn't even know to say when are you going to get a real job because they wouldn't even know what I was talking about, right? It's like so investors don't even exist, right? It's this completely different situation, and now it's so popular that there's all this like infrastructure. There's like it seems like most startups exist now to help other startups, right? There's this whole like ecosystem.
I think this is a great point because compared to a couple years ago, I just feel like the difference now is that we can experience more examples. There's just more companies out there for an aspiring entrepreneur to look to say, oh, wow, they can do that, I can do it.
Well, the cultural acceptance perhaps has gone so far that it's become romanticized. I don't know if at your current companies you get applicants who have no idea how hard it will be to work at a startup.
Well, YC certainly gets those applicants.
Yeah,
hard.
This is true.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true that there's been a somewhat romanticization, I'm sure if that's a word, of founding companies, but I still believe it's a net good because what will happen is that people will, currently I believe people overassess the risk of starting a company. Like the risk is actually, it's pretty unlikely that you'll work on something for 12 months and if it doesn't work out that you're going to be left in like an irreparable situation where you'll be working menial jobs for the rest of your life. So I think people, one, start off from a baseline where they overassess how much risk is involved in starting a company.
Although, listening to Jude's story.
Still would have done it every time, ten times in a row.
Even if HeyZap had gone under and you had been left with like $1,000 worth of credit card debt, like presumably
it
over the course
been,
of your life.
Yeah, you could have bounced back.
You would figure out something. So I believe people start from a baseline of overassessing risk, but the point I was going to make is if there's a romanticization, you'll get a lot of people who will start companies and realize it's not for them. But you'll also get a lot of people who will actually be very good at it and be successful who may not otherwise have ever tried. And even the people who it turns out realized weren't cut out for starting a company or didn't work out for a reason, I personally believe will be more productive members of society because they'll be better employees. They'll have had this experience of having tried something and learned a huge amount about themselves and apply those lessons to what they go on to do next. So I believe that actually things like the Facebook movie and reality TV shows about startups, as annoying as they can be, are probably actually a net good.
Okay. We're going to be getting to your questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have something to ask, please formulate your question and line up at the mic right about now. Again, we're looking for a single one-part question, no pitches, stories, or multiple questions, please. There's a tradition that's been in place for many batches now where on the first dinner of a new batch, alums come and talk about what they wish they had known but didn't, and impart their wisdom to the incoming class. Do any of you have some stories that you remember, memories of the presentations you heard or that you have given yourself?
I remember 3 points very distinctly that I shared with one of the batches, which was, you know, came directly from our Go Meet the People experience, where we photographed apartments and got to sit down in the living rooms of our customers. And it was simple 3 steps. It was release your product, go meet the people using it, and iterate as fast as you possibly can. And that was the formula that got us through the program. Release your product. Don't wait till launch it.
Right.
Like, don't build for a year and think everything's going to be perfect and we're going to launch a year from now. Release. That was one of Paul Graham's great tenets.
That was a very important mantra, to get the product out, something out for the people and see what it was like.
Yeah, I'll never forget. It's just like ringing in my head, like, release, don't launch. Release, don't launch. And once you do, go meet the people. Talk to them. Understand, empathize with them. Understand what their concerns are. And then get back to work. Iterate fast.
One of the things that I like to say all the time, I can't remember who said this to me first. It may have been actually Justin, who said to one of the batches, money raised and employees hired are not metrics for success. In Y Combinator, especially now as the batches have gotten really big, it feels competitive inside YC. And there's this kind of mentality that you want to win YC, right? You want to have the best looking startup after 3 months. And really, like, after 3 months, your company can only be so good, right? So people get so obsessed with, like, what can you do in 3 months? Well, one of the things you can do is you can raise a big fat round and create all this hype. And you can use that big fat round to hire tons of people, and it makes you feel like there's all this progress. But, you know, if you apply that money to the wrong thing, right, what difference did it make, right? You've sold a chunk of your company for no gain. And I feel like it's very easy these days for founders to get caught up in the, I just want to be a star, I want to be like a founder people look up to, rather than I want to be the founder of a successful business. And that's a reality check people need to go through more and more often these days. Because it is easy right now, right? You go through times where it is easy to raise a lot of money, and you have to keep in mind that, like, you still have to work. You still have to do quite a bit of work.
I think PG actually, PG puts this pretty well. He says you can fool investors, you can fool the press, can fool employees, but you can't fool users. Like, users turn up to your product and either they like it or they don't. They don't care if you're particularly charismatic. They don't care how much money you've raised. They just care whether what sort of your product helps them in any way.
Yeah.
That comes to the central, like, mantra of Y Combinator, of making something that people want. Sorry, I think my microphone's half on.
So making something that people want is a message that gets hammered into our head at the early days of Y Combinator, and I think that remains true. I think a lot of the other rules have actually changed, releasing fast nowadays.
There's lots of debate of whether you should release in 6 months. If you're doing enterprise software, you may not want to release on the first day that you start working on the code, because you're going to embarrass yourself in front of Microsoft. But one thing has never changed. It's making something that people want.
It blows me away that was on the first t-shirts they gave us in 2005, make something people want. And at the time, I thought it was kind of hokey. And then I even found myself saying it, like, to advise to other people, not even thinking that was, like, why Combinator had, like, incepted this idea into my head. And, all of their advice has changed, except make something people want. It's so critically important. And people miss it, though. It's very simple advice, but that's at the root of everything we're doing, I think.
Right. Let's turn to your questions. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inform, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Y Combinator, the secret in this incubator's sauce. We're here with Harj Tagger, partner at Y Combinator, Joe Gebbia, chief product officer and co-founder of Airbnb, Steve Huffman, co-founder of HipMonk and Reddit, and Jude Gamilla, co-founder of HayzApp. And I'm Randall Strauss, author of The Launchpad Inside Y Combinator, Silicon Valley's Most Exclusive School for Startups. So we are looking for single one-part questions that are actually questions. You may begin.
Thank you. Thank you guys for taking the time. My question is, what trend do you see in startups? Is it going to still be in tech or another industry in, say, maybe like a year to 5 years from now?
Well, I would dispute your premise and then look straight at Joe, because, you know, Airbnb isn't a technology company, right? They're one of the largest YC companies, but, you know, they're affecting people's lives in a much more profound way than, you know, just optimizing, you know, chatting, social, that sort of thing, right?
Thanks, Steve. I'll add on to that. I think from our perspective, what we see happening and where we see things going is there'll be this really beautiful convergence of online and offline. As the internet has matured from the early days of people's concerns about putting credit cards on the internet to then we have this kind of critical mass of people now on the internet kind of in the 2000s. What do we do with them? Well, let's connect them through social networks. And now here we are in the third decade of the internet. I think what I see is us coming up with services and products that use the power of the internet to connect people face-to-face in the real world. And I think that's what this decade will be about.
Hello, my name is Matt Tindall, and my question is about the, what do you think about the future of YC, how it will evolve over the next 5 years, say, because I know in the past batch, they've finally acknowledged the certain scaling challenges with just adding more and more people to it over time. So what do you think about the future, and how is it going to change?
Harj, you want to feel that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's true. We scaled back the batch because there are a number of things that didn't work as well on the previous batch as we would have hoped. The plan is not to continue scaling back, though. If I take a step back, there's actually something that sort of a philosophy behind Y Combinator that a lot of people don't realize, which is pretty interesting. And it is like the entire world of investing is based on sort of, if you look at the distribution of returns or the money that investors make, it comes from a very small number of companies. And traditionally, research has shown that there's only 10 of those companies that will be formed each year. And the definition is a company that will go on to do 100 million in revenue. And so everyone wants to get one of those 10 companies. Y Combinator believes that 10 is a sort of artificial number, and it's been at that because it just sort of traditional barriers to starting companies exist. There's no reason why that number couldn't be 15 or 20 or 30 or 40. And so Y Combinator is less about trying to identify the 10 and get into those deals and more about trying to just expand the whole pool. So that's why scaling is interesting to Y Combinator. It's because we want to create more like Dropbox and Airbnb scale companies. So I expect you will see Y Combinator continue to scale over the future, but we also take things batch by batch. We see at the end of each batch, we see what worked, what didn't work, and what should we tweak or change for the next batch. And so, and that's actually what keeps it interesting, being a part of the sort of team at YC, is not knowing exactly what it's going to become, but sort of hoping it's going to become something very interesting.
Y Combinator is still a startup itself?
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Hi. My question's about diversity of incubators and venture capital. Some of you mentioned the personal connection you had to PG that helped you get into the program. And we've heard about venture capitalists who like to invest in founders that are like themselves. And I'm wondering if you could address that. Is it even an issue?
So I've noticed a trend. I mean, at the start, for my batch, we had 14 companies in the batch. What was the last batch? 60, 80?
The last batch was 88, I think.
Okay. So I don't think we had any female founders at all in our batch. But I've gone back every, like twice a year, to watch all the presentations scaling up to 80 or 60. And I'm seeing a higher proportion of female founders come in. It's still fairly low. But the percentage is, I would say, rising. I mean, there's a lot of noise in the system, but I would say the percentage is rising. On the VC front, I don't really have any direct data.
Hi, I was just interested in this hypothesis that there could be 15, 20, 30, 40 companies a year that are over 100 million in revenue. Could you talk any more about your thoughts behind that? Why? What leads to that hypothesis?
What else is there? There's not a huge amount beyond it. It's a hypothesis. It's just a belief that no one has ever tried to sort of mass produce startups, and we want to see whether that's possible or not. And so that's really all to it. We don't know if it's possible. We don't actually know. Maybe there's at some point there's a limit of the number of companies you can have. There are trends that people talk about. Mark Andreessen's coined the term like software eats the world, and I would say like Airbnb is an example of a company that's sort of software based, but it's sort of an industry. It's not like technology. It's sort of expanded into the sort of essentially killing the hotel industry, and you would never have sort of seen a software business do that traditionally. So that's like one trend that may play into it. But honestly, we don't know. We just want to see if it's possible.
I think there's one way you could study it. You could look at the market caps of all markets and how they're growing. And then you could say a startup that comes in to disrupt the market is going to compress the profits or compress the revenues of that market by disrupting it. And therefore you could work out how many companies you could actually produce in that year that would be able to disrupt it. It just happens to be 10 right now. But maybe you could find out an upper limit of whether it could be 50 or 100 and see the trends in it. So it may be modelable.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Ken Sen Gu. I just moved from Tennessee to here. I'm doing my own startup too. I haven't really applied for Y Combinator, but my question is general, like, what if those startup that doesn't really get into Y Combinator, they apply, got rejected, and you know, one of the things that Y Combinator provides is connections, also the brand, so that if you are funded by Y Combinator in the Bay Area, people know that you probably is a good startup to a certain degree. So how about those who didn't get into Y Combinator? They are thousands of them. And
Jude, you were mentioning some friends who were not, did not get in.
On the last batch, six teams of friends of mine applied for Y Combinator and didn't get in. So
what do you suggest what they do? Like maybe they have like thousands of
views. They have to hustle. It's basically down to that. They've got to use everything they've got, all their energy, all their creativity, to work it out. And to be honest, if you look at all the companies out there, 99.999999% of successful companies in the last 2,000 years didn't go through YC. So you got to hustle.
I think one thing to add on to that that they look for in the interview process is pure passion for what you're doing. And if you're truly passionate about what you're doing, it doesn't matter if you get into YC or not. You will find a way to build it and ship it and get into the hands of people that you're building for.
I see. Okay. I see. Next.
Hi. How do you guys recommend finding co-founders or other people who want to start companies?
Good question.
Well, I would say that's maybe one of the hardest problems. It's probably harder than raising money by 100x, and I think it's harder than hiring your first employee and your second employee and your third employee. So it's harder than hiring, and hiring is harder than fundraising. So it's your hardest challenge. So you either go solo, or like I would say, look around at your friends, look at the people that you've known for a long time that you really like and you can trust, because it comes down to trust, I think, a lot of the times. And a lot of the co-founders that have fallen apart and split up their teams, it's because they didn't trust each other. And they don't have to look at the dollars and the nickels. And, you know, it comes down to passion, trust, and they're in it to win it. They're in it for the long term. And they're not in it for a quick flip, selling it in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. They're up for building a company together, and they enjoy it, and they have fun while building it.
I would add on that, you know, if you didn't meet that co-founder in college, You know, and if you don't have somebody in your close circle of friends, you should join another startup. You know, at Hipmunk, we hire people, and often, like, one of the things I tell developers is, you know, think of this as your startup boot camp. You know, join us, learn what it's like to be at a startup, you know, hone your skills, make some friends, and you'll be prepared so when you want to do it yourself, you'll know the game a little better. And I've seen that amongst our employees, right? I see guys who didn't know each other becoming very close friends, and I'm certain a couple of them at some point in their careers will work together. But you need to put yourself in a position to meet like-minded people. I think a very great place to do that is at other startups. And, oh, by the way, just about every startup is hiring. It's, you know, and it's really easy to hire somebody who wants to do their own thing because you can already tell they're going to do a good job at whatever they do, or at least they're going to give it, you know, they're going to give it their all, and that's, you know, that's what we look for. We look for future founders, and we want to hire them, and we want to tell them, like, you're a future founder, but come work for us for, you know, a couple of years.
Yes, on this side.
Yes, hi. So right now there is, there are many incubators in Silicon Valley. So you as a startup, or we or me as a potential candidate, how will you pitch Y Combinator as a, why would I go to you and not to another one? Like.
I wasn't aware there were any other ones. I don't know. It's hard. It's hard. It's hard for me to answer that accurately, because to give you an accurate answer, I'd have to have experience with, like, other incubators. I only really have experience with Y Combinator. So the most useful advice I could give is speak to people who have been through Y Combinator and been through other ones, and ask them, like, questions about their experiences, and just go with the one that feels right to you based on talking to people who have gone through the programs.
Do you think Y Combinator have something unique, or that makes
Y Combinator has is it's been around the longest. It sort of created this accelerator, or whatever you want to label the term, industry. It has the largest data set of companies. None of the accelerators are funded anywhere close to the number of companies Y Combinator has. And fundamentally, it has the best track record of producing large companies like Airbnb, Dropbox. It's just been around the longest, has the largest alumni network, has the most brand. That's what I would say. I feel like we have more experience at sort of the specific life cycle of a startup that we're involved with than probably anyone else.
I'll just add on to that. I think the reason to do YC is because you'll have the most productive 3 months of your entire life.
Succinct? Yes, on this side.
So we talked about the romanticization of doing a startup, kind of on the entrepreneur side. But there's, like, the flip side of that on the investor side. And we've got the Jobs Act coming, allowing crowdfunding. You don't have to be accredited investor. How do you think that's going to affect YC and the startup ecosystem?
It's not something we think about. It's not something that we think about at YC too often, just because we're so early. For the most part, we're funding companies before they're even companies. We're funding companies before they're even at the stage of getting onto a crowdfunding platform. And I also think, I think Naval from AngelList puts this pretty well, of you seeing an increasing sort of separation between advice and money in the investing world. And while sort of the Y Combinator funding amount of $17,000 to $20,000 is important for some people, for a lot of people it's a sort of insignificant amount of money, and they're mainly doing Y Combinator for advice, connections, and a lot of things that we bring that just having a sort of crowdfunded round can't bring you. So from that perspective, I don't worry about it, or we don't think about it.
Do you think it's a net positive? You said it was net positive for getting people into the ecosystem. Is money coming in from mom and pops?
I think the Jobs Act, yes, actually, because the Jobs Act is still fairly well regulated. Like, if you're making less than $40,000, you still can't invest more than 1% of your net worth in startups. So I don't think it's encouraging. I don't think it's any more dangerous to society than promotion of lottery tickets, for example. And so yeah, actually, I do think it's a net positive.
Yes.
So I'm curious to know, in each of your different companies, was it more about founding the passion that you felt for that particular idea, or was it more about being an entrepreneur and an in-game at some point?
Well, I can answer that question with neither of those responses. With Reddit, we were just along for the ride. We were just like, hey, this is great. You know, let's delay real life for a little bit and just go on this adventure. And then it turned into this huge thing. But we had no idea what we were building or why we were building it. There were moments, you know, when Reddit started to grow, when we stopped faking all of our traffic and users, when like we had real people, we were like, this is really, really cool. We're affecting people's lives. And the hair still stands up on my arm when I think about that moment. But we didn't do that on purpose. We just did it because, you know, why not? We were 20. With Hipmonk, part of it was, you know, after doing Reddit, which wasn't a business, it was just this thing, this amazingly growing thing. With Hipmonk, I kept saying, like, I just want to be involved in the exchange of money. You know, I'm going to start a business. And at the same time, my co-founder Adam was like, we should fix travel. And I was like, yeah, you're right, travel sucks, let's do that. So that was, you know, and it's weird having like a flippant conversation about like the next like 10 years of your life. But I don't know, for me, that's what it was. It was just, okay, well, we can do a better job and it'll be easier than Reddit, so why not?
Okay. It's time for our last question, and it is the informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following: Harsh, Joe, Steve, and Jude. What are your 60-second ideas to change the world? Harsh, you want to go first? 60 seconds, go.
I would say a chip embedded in your body that continuously monitors your sort of vital statistics, things like your blood sugar level, your blood pressure, and sends that to a server somewhere, which is continually monitoring them and displaying that data to you. So at all times, you sort of know, you have like real-time data on your body. I think that would actually be pretty transformative.
For those who want to apply to YC.
I mean, it may not be the most trivial thing to build and get user adoption for.
Joe?
We believe in a world where things can be shared. And it may be your room, it may be other things in the future. We believe in this world where access is more powerful than ownership. Where in the future, having access to something, whether it's music or a room or other things, will be more powerful than owning those things. And we call this the sharing economy. And for us, what will change the world is this notion that we'll all be more efficient with the things that we have in our lives. And through that, we'll be connecting people face-to-face all over the world. And there's something really powerful that happened this past year that exemplifies this. After Hurricane Sandy, one of our hosts in Brooklyn, a woman named Shell, volunteered her 5 guest rooms to those displaced by the hurricane. Email went around the company. Within hours, everyone in the company had seen what Shell was doing. And it completely inspired something inside of Airbnb. And we said, my God, we have to do something with this. We spent the next 24 hours completely overhauling our payment system so that any host in New York City could volunteer their room to those displaced by the hurricane. Within a matter of a day, we had over 1,000 rooms on the site for free for those who got flooded, those who were stranded. And we saw this kind of supernatural power of what happens when you build a community that's involved in sharing.
Steve.
Okay. Once again, I'm the unfortunate guy who's put in the position of following Joe. I've seen this happen to people before. No, so I don't know the specific idea, but the space is definitely education. We're in this situation right now with humanity where just about anybody, certainly anybody in modern society has access to all of like humanity's knowledge, literally at their fingertips. But we still have the situation where we kind of force people into this, you know, this very rigid schooling that ends when you're about 21. And then you go through this kind of brief period of your life until you're 5 years old where you learn this incredible amount of information. Then everything slows way, way down. And then when you're 21, it stops almost altogether. And I just think that's just such a shame. And we have so many people who like to teach and like to talk and like to share, and the information is all there. Humanity must find a better way to simplify the sharing and spreading of knowledge and not have it end so early in life.
Jude?
So I've got a kind of an idea of how maybe you could transcribe your neurons in your neocortex or your memory and try and encode it into a bacteria and keep your memories forever. And this is part of backing up your brain. I'm very interested in computer-brain interfaces, and I think the brain is one of the last places that we haven't really understood or explored. So to the education point, maybe we can enhance our education, speed up the fact that we have to spend 20 years learning about life before we can do anything. And I'm very interested in hacking the brain, how we can back up memories and communicate better and know what each other's thinking through electronic means without having to talk necessarily.
Thank you. Let's give a round of applause to... Thank you. Thank you, Harj, Joe, Steve, and Jude, for sharing your experiences of Y Combinator and beyond. This meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.